HelpSyriasKids.org. We are connecting the Hudson community with a Syrian refugee camp in Ketermaya, Lebanon. You're listening to WGXC Acra.
Tune in to the WGXC Monday Morning Show, presented to you by yours truly, Simon Says. Playing music as it is and reading news as it was. Every Monday, tune in.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by the Healthcare Consortium, a rural health network dedicated to improving access to healthcare and supporting the health and well-being of the people in our rural community. Throughout 2018, the Healthcare Consortium will be celebrating 20 years of serving the residents of Columbia and Greene counties. To learn more about the Healthcare Consortium and its services, please visit www.columbiahealthnet.org or call 518-822-8820.
I like marijuana, you like marijuana, we like marijuana too. I want to be a runaway, got to leave home for marijuana. Remember the teeny bop sniffing airplane glue? Marijuana. He used to freak out in Central Park too. I got to say goodbye for push, you got to get your high on marijuana. It's my life and I do what I want. Marijuana. It's my life and I do what I can't. Marijuana. I want to smoke pot and I want to smoke a lot. But here comes my father, the marijuana cop. I like marijuana, you like marijuana.
Hello, Radio Land, and welcome back to the Medical Freedom Show. This is your host, Heather Martin. We broadcast to you the second Monday of every month from 2 to 3 p.m. And I'm going to call in our special guest for today. We have Dr. William Hurwitz joining us today. Dr. Hurwitz is a doctor who has been treating chronic pain. Welcome, Dr. Hurwitz. Okay, let me make an adjustment here. Okay, Dr. Hurwitz, can you hear me?
I can. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. All right, contact made. So, Dr. Hurwitz, welcome to the Medical Freedom Show. So glad to have you today.
Happy to be here.
Thank you very much for being here. So I was beginning to introduce you that you are a doctor who has been treating people in chronic pain, and you've suffered a lot of the backlash and repercussions coming down on good doctors who are trying to treat people. These repercussions are coming on in the name of the war on drugs, and they're getting in the way of doctors treating patients, as you yourself know all too well. So this morning before the show, I was reviewing an article that you sent me and also watching a good part of the documentary that you were featured in. It was called Doctor Feel Good, Healer or Dealer. Unfortunately, that's not a public link, is it, for that movie?
The documentary is on Netflix.
It is on Netflix.
Yes.
Okay. So it's a documentary that is on Netflix, and it's Dr. Feelgood, Healer or Dealer, and Dr. Hurwitz is featured prominently in that documentary. And just watching the documentary this morning, just seemed to just keep reiterating or reaffirming to me the real need we have for medical freedom in our country. And it's just it's a freedom, it's a right that was spoken about early in our country's history, one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence. Dr. Benjamin Rush, he was urging for a medical freedom provision to be made. He said, we have this wonderful provision for freedom of religion, but without doing the same for medicine, we're setting ourselves up for a tyranny in which medicine can only be practiced by a certain select class. And that's really what we've seen come about. Dr. Hurwitz, in that video, one of the things I really appreciated that you said is how you're treating patients differently than the standard model, not as an powerful authority figure, but treating people as an equal, listening to the patients. Can you talk a little bit about that approach that you have to medicine?
Well, there are two things. First of all, my practice was focused on patients who had failed all prior interventions from surgery, physical therapy, pain hardening, any number of things that had been tried and were really on their, what shall I say, at the limits of their tolerance.
Yeah.
And whose lives have been severely impaired. And for such patients, they're used to either being stigmatized and demeaned or bossed around by their doctors.
Yeah.
In fact, the mode that has come into being, although I don't know if it's active under the current restrictive regime, is to essentially sign away your rights as a patient, in which you agree to be put through what amounts to an involuntary and painful withdrawal if you are deemed to have misbehaved. And this was not my approach, first of all. Second of all, these medicines are complicated. There are subtle differences or not so subtle differences between morphine, methadone, Demerol, oxycodone, hydrocodone, Dilaudid, fentanyl. And those differences make a difference when you're treating a particular patient who may respond with everything from hypomania to sedation, depending on how they respond to the particular medicine. And therefore, it's inconceivable to me to practice medicine without getting intelligent and honest feedback from patients about how they respond. And so, that is a watchword or guide to how I practice medicine, which was to find out how people responded and to adjust the treatment accordingly.
Right. And what you're saying is something that I find myself saying very often, is that when you have blanket rules about medicine, how it's supposed to be prescribed, what's supposed to be used in situation XYZ, when you have these sort of blanket rules, they don't work well with human physiology because people are all very different. How one person is going to react in a given situation is different from how another person might react in exactly the same situation. So you're dealing with all of these variables. But what the regulations try to do is just put out a blanket rule and everybody has to be treated this way. And
That's compounded by the actual lack of experience of most doctors in using these medications.
Right.
So that they're relegated to sort of standard formulas or recipes, which in most circumstances are a rough, at least beginner's guide to what to do. The issue is, there's a distinction between treating acute pain or post-operative pain and treating chronic pain. And first of all, in acute pain, it doesn't go on that long and you don't necessarily get very much feedback. And by the time you got the feedback, the intervention is probably less important. With chronic pain, the development of tolerance to medications is almost inevitable. Certain kinds of toxicities become more important than others. And one needs a strategy to respond to the various complications that, that develop.
Right.
So treating chronic pain is quite different than the circumstance in which most doctors are exposed to treating pain at all.
But generally, the people who have the most knowledge and expertise about the situation, the illness, and the medicines to treat it are those people who are suffering from the affliction. I know as they
often have more knowledge than their doctors.
Yeah, they do. And then they're punished for having that knowledge because having that knowledge is seen as proof of addiction and
Beyond that, the doctors who undertake the treatment of such patients are often punished, as I was, and as many of my colleagues were, so that those people who gained some expertise, in fact, their expertise is lost to the medical community.
Right, exactly.
Let me say that one learns by making mistakes, but if you criminalize mistakes, then you kill the people who are making them and you don't learn from them.
Absolutely. I totally agree.
And the perverse consequence of this is that, in effect, there's a new crop of naive doctors being prosecuted for making the same mistakes an older generation did.
Right. And, you sent me another article from, what was it? Was it not the Smithsonian? Hold on, I have it up here on my... it was from The Guardian, the making of an opioid epidemic. And so you sent me this article this morning, and I was reading through it, and a lot of what I see in there is a lot of the same propaganda.
Hello, I lost you for a second.
Oh, I'm
Hello?
Here. Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, I'm back.
All right, good to have you back. I was just talking a little bit about, I was just talking about the article that I read this morning, the one you sent me from The Guardian, The Making of an Opioid Epidemic.
Oh, right.
And how there's so much of the old propaganda in this article, but a couple of things that...
Well, let me take issue with you for a second. I think that there is a common misconception that demonizes the drugs as the source of the epidemic, and
right.
therefore demonizes the doctors mm-hmm. who provide medications as the source of the epidemic.
Yeah,
I think I would look at it more as if the population susceptible to the epidemic of opioid abuse is like dry kindling. And it may be that the increased availability of opioids was like the spark that allowed this dry kindling to catch fire.
Okay, but then why would there be this dry kindling?
But it's not been necessary to sustain it.
Well, also, I've heard from other statistics that the rate of actual opioid addiction has relatively remained unchanged since the post-Civil War era when it was legally available. I don't believe for one minute that increased supply is causing any sort of epidemic. What we do have is prohibition. And when we had an alcohol prohibition, we saw the same things. We saw substances becoming radically more dangerous. Since the end of the prohibition, there's quality control measures in alcohol production. Alcohol is still dangerous. People still die from alcohol. But we as a people have recognized that this is a necessary danger to live with, that actually having a prohibition against alcohol is far more dangerous than just trying to coexist with alcohol and using approaches like education, like advertising with use responsibly. They're a better approach than a prohibition. The prohibition, it creates a situation where the substances become more valuable than gold. So there's real economic incentives for people who are in chronic pain to be victims of criminals for robberies so that they can get the drugs and subvert them on the markets, on the black market. But all of these things come about when you have a prohibition. If these were medicines that were available freely to any person 18 and older in a drugstore, you wouldn't be seeing the same kind of problems that you're seeing now. You wouldn't be seeing people who are really experts in using a substance suddenly OD because they've gotten a substance that's now 100 times stronger than what they're used to working with, or maybe what they've been working with is really underpowered, so they're used to dealing with it at a certain dosage. With a black market, with illegally produced and obtained substances, it just makes the situation more dangerous. People are not going to stop using these medicines recreationally. They never have. This has been... it's as old as human history. So the prohibition creates so many problems for people.
And I don't disagree with you about the adverse consequences of prohibition, but my understanding is that, in fact, death rates have increased, perhaps because prohibition
increased
more for dangerous medications.
Well,
but
because,
I was actually making a different point.
What people are buying on the street, okay? If they're going out trying to buy heroin, they don't know if they're getting something that's derived from a poppy flower or if it's something that was cooked up as a chemical concoction, might have no relationship to that poppy flower and might kill them. You had it with cannabis. When there was more of a cannabis prohibition, we had the Paraquat, where the U.S. government was actually encouraging the Mexican government to spray this herbicide, pesticide, Paraquat on the cannabis. And it was coming back into the United States, and like every family had a story of a young person smoking a joint and going to the hospital. It got a whole generation to actually believe that cannabis was dangerous. But again, you have these life-threatening issues come up in a prohibition.
Again, I wasn't disagreeing with the adverse effects of prohibition, but I think there is a separate issue, which is, what is it that makes some people susceptible to drug addiction and or alcohol addiction as an escape? And
One thing I really believe is that there are people with certain kinds of health problems that are no longer deemed treatable with opiates. For example, psychological disorders. Nobody's treating psychological disorders with opiates. that's considered medicine that's no longer practiced. However, a couple of years ago, I was at an event memorializing youth suicides, and this mother was talking about her son who struggled with, I think it was bipolar disorder. And she was saying how he went to the doctors and they would try this medicine on him, that medicine. And every time they tried an approved medicine for his condition, he would be made worse. It would make him sicker. She said, but then he got into heroin. And when he was high on the heroin, he was perfectly fine. Now, she didn't even, I don't think she understood the significance in the words she was saying. And I'm like, hello, where is the doctor to say, hey, Eureka, we found something that works. Let's try to work with this for you. Let's try to find you the dose that's going to be manageable, that's going to help you the best. Let's get you a source of clean medicine so you don't have to go out and buy this on the street. But for someone in that young man's situation, when you have a health problem and then you find that this medicine actually helps, but it's not chronic pain, it's not something that now would give you any kind of clearance to get the substance, but yet that might be the only thing that works. So, it's when people are arrested for opiate use that's unauthorized, I don't think anyone sits down and says, what are you getting out of this? What is this medicine doing for you? Because you might actually hear people say things like, well, this gets me over my anxiety so I can function. This helps me to get out of bed in the day and live a productive life. The same things that chronic pain patients are reporting. So there's an
I'm sure you're right that these medicines have a therapeutic effect that apart from their treatment of pain. Mm-hmm. I had a patient who was actually disabled due to severe depression who had a number of other medical problems. Mm-hmm. And the psychiatrist who was managing him noticed that when he was given oxycodone for post-operative pain after surgery, his depression cleared.
Mm-hmm.
So the psychiatrist ended off sending him to me both for treatment of his depression as well as treatment of his chronic pain syndrome. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the oxycodone did have an antidepressant effect and it was successful in maintaining him.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think that you're missing a point I was trying to make, however.
Okay.
And the point that I was trying to make was that there are, whether we call it an epidemic, I think there's been a recent set of studies suggesting that non-college educated whites are dying at an increasing rate, in contradiction to almost everybody else in advanced economies or even blacks and Hispanics in this country. And there's an article written by Ann Case, and I forget the first name, Deaton, who's an economist and her husband, who described diseases of despair.
Mm-hmm.
And they were talking about an increase in the frequency of overdose deaths and deaths by cirrhosis and alcohol overuse. And I think that there is a change, and that that change could fairly be referred to as an epidemic. And whether or not the statistics on drug use are relatively unchanged, I think there is an issue relating to who it is that's dying and why they're dying, or why they're trying to escape from an otherwise unpleasant or difficult life.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's part of the story. And the point I was making for is that blaming doctors and drugs for this actually misses the point
that
there are elements of the way in which our society is organized or provides, fails to provide support for people who are, victims of social and economic and other changes, whether it's loneliness or unemployment.
I totally agree with that. Are you are you familiar with the Rat Park studies done by Professor Bruce K. Alexander?
Not by name. That is, I may know what were the studies.
The Rat Park studies were with rats and opiates, where he had rats, trying to remember if he used heroin or morphine for the study. I think it was.
Oh, is this the one where they'll do it until they die unless they're in a social context?
Right. They put the substance in the little cage where it's just the rat, the dispenser, and nothing else, and the rats would just keep dosing till they died, and then he put them into a social environment and still had the substances available, readily available. And yes, some of the rats continued to use them in moderation, recreationally, but you didn't see rats just sitting there hitting the dispenser till they died. It just was non-existent. And you're absolutely right, is that our society is very sick.
Well, no, but the point is that the reductionist explanation, that is that it's the drugs and or vicariously the doctors that are causing the problem, is a misdiagnosis.
Absolutely.
And if there's a misdiagnosis for which there's a mistaken treatment, which is criminalization, then not only does one not address the underlying issues and social existence that lead to the epidemic, but it has all of the adverse consequences you referred to earlier about prohibition and criminalization.
Mm-hmm. And absolutely,
So in a way, my condemnation would be that this is a missed opportunity.
It is.
Partly because by criminalizing doctors, they've missed the opportunity to gain from their collective experience.
Mm-hmm.
Second of all, by misdiagnosing and using doctors as scapegoats for this problem, they fail to address or design mechanisms to deal with what are the underlying problems.
Absolutely. On that note, I'd like to just kind of give you the floor for, like, what do you see as some solutions to those issues?
Let's say that with respect to the people whose lives and livelihoods have been adversely affected by the introduction of cheap labor around the world, and therefore whose manual labor has been demeaned, I think there needs to be either some sort of compensation for the losses of jobs and income, or the creation of opportunities that, in fact, would use the skills that those people have to improve infrastructure or to educate. What strikes me is that production of things has actually evolved to very high levels of efficiency.
Mm-hmm.
That is, whether it's farming. Farming used to have, 70, 80, 90% of the population engaged in food production and distribution, and now it's something like 3%. So all of a sudden, we had a lot of people who were subsisting on farms who no longer needed to farm. Or previously, you had a lot of people making automobiles. Mm-hmm. And with automated factories, you don't need so many people to do that stuff.
Yeah.
But what also strikes me is that with expanding knowledge, there are expanding issues to be resolved.
Mm-hmm.
And the opportunities to educate people to, say, understand neurophysiology, to understand electronics, to understand information, to understand 6 billion topics.
One thing I see is that our society is kind of moving away from really even allowing people to take responsibility for themselves. Like, even in the medical situation, there's all this liability held against doctors, patients are virtually powerless, and yet they're not able to take responsibility for themselves. So you see more and more of this irresponsible behavior. And I think the solution is...
What I was saying, though, is that it's not just in the medical context, that the opportunities for independent action have been foreclosed. So that I remember, at least parenthetically, my grandfather was a Lithuanian immigrant here in the early 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
And like most early immigrants, he would come here and he was a traveling salesman with a little cart, and he would sell stuff off his cart. you couldn't survive these days in that kind of role.
Right.
Because the opportunities in the economy have been foreclosed by the degree of centralization by big corporations.
Yep.
And by
I have to jump in right now and let our listeners know that you are listening to WGXC ACRA 90.7 FM. You are listening to the Medical Freedom Show. I am your host, Heather Martin. Today, I'm joined by Dr. William Hurwitz, who is a doctor who's been embattled for the treatment of chronic pain. I want to remind our listeners that this is a live show and you can call in with your questions or comments for Dr. Hurwitz or myself. The studio call-in line is area code 518-828-0290. Again, that number is 518-828-0290. Now, Dr. Hurwitz, getting back to our conversation, we've hit upon a point that I think is just so germane to the social situation that's going right now with so-called opioid epidemic. I really personally don't believe in it, but there is something going on with the prohibition and with some very, very depressed people in America, which brings us back to our economy, to the barriers we have to entry into work, the lack of availability of work that is sustainable, that's full-time, that pays enough to live on, and also that is in a kind of work environment that is physically sustainable. A lot of people eventually end up with chronic pain and chronic health problems because of the work that they're forced to do.
Working. Well, I agree with you, but the issue you raised is what would I do to fix that?
I don't expect you to have all the answers. I just wanted to give you a platform for ideas, because one of the things I like to do, in addition to just talking about the problems, is also to try to kind of collectively envision some solutions. Like, here are the problems. Where could we move from here?
Well, I think there are other points, which is that this culture is torn between, on the one hand, a kind of Puritanism.
Yes.
And on the other hand, a reaction to that, which is an overemphasis on self-indulgence.
Mm-hmm. Hedonism.
And in a way, at least some of the use of drugs is part of that overindulgence,
mm-hmm.
or at least the black market illicit use of drugs. What I was going to say is that one does need really a different cultural mode, and you need people who represent this cultural mode who are respected.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, one of the features of American life is its pervasive anti-intellectualism and anti-elitism.
Yeah.
And however well-deserved the political elite might be for its negligence of many mm-hmm. of the social problems that are now extant, it still raises at least the aberration that a new generation would focus on things that are more productive and healthier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I definitely agree. I see kind of like our situation, the whole structure kind of seems to need a rebuild. You know, I've often thought about like hospitals and how lonely and detached they are from the rest of society. And like, you know, if there was some way to structure things differently where it could be more like a community.
Well,
and caregiving more as a community of volunteers and to kind of take some of the burden off of the nursing staff that's overworked and underpaid often, and they don't have enough hands to go around. It's just like things I think about when I'm in those situations, like how could we make this into a more healthy society?
Well, I think that among the issues are that we're individualists.
Mm-hmm.
And we think of ourselves almost, not completely, but almost completely as individual consumers. And that we don't think of ourselves primarily as members of a collective. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not saying that, this is actually more complicated than I can express in bumper sticker ideas.
Yeah.
But the issue of the communal support in hospitals, mm-hmm, is no different than the issue of isolated people as they age or as,
right,
their relatives die,
yeah,
off, or the fact that we now have more 1 and 2 children family than, mm-hmm, we have 3 or 4 or 5 children family, and therefore fewer relatives, fewer cousins, fewer aunts and uncles.
I saw some video of a nursing home that was like also part of a daycare center, preschool for kids, that had the 2 generations interacting.
Yeah, well, there may be institutional arrangements that could find broad appeal, mm-hmm, in which older people or retired people or working people could take a bigger part in education. One of my thoughts about education, actually, is that we put apprenticeship at the wrong end, that we treat schools pretty much like assembly lines, mm-hmm, with interchangeable students.
Yeah.
And that as I think about the education of doctors or lawyers or, mm-hmm, or scientists, it's at the upper end that they get personal hands-on tutoring, so to speak,
mm-hmm,
or at least models of mature professional behavior.
Uh-huh.
And that it seems to me that an apprenticeship that began at a much, much younger age would change both the mentality of children, our growing adolescents,
mm-hmm,
by involving them in a broader social organization that included adults who had authority and who, in fact,
yeah,
determined in part what their futures were likely to be, and therefore provided a very different incentive system,
mm-hmm,
than the current quasi-prison-like incentive system built into many public schools.
Yeah, you know, you talked about the missed opportunity to look at, you know, why is there basically such widespread depression in the United States? And instead, they're looking at criminalizing doctors and patients instead of looking at the root cause. Well, why do these people who, even those who aren't in chronic pain, why are they so willing to end their lives? Why do they have such a low value on their lives? But, now, also, it's another lost opportunity I've always thought is with the school shootings. You know, they're so quick to talk about gun control. Well, let's talk about these institutions that are making kids want to bring in a gun and shoot everyone. It's because it is a quasi-prison situation. So there's no discussion about changing the system of schooling to make it more humanized, to make it more personal. Like you're saying, to give more of that interpersonal connection to a young person, that mentoring, that apprenticeship, and we don't have that.
I was going to say, once we've lost the economic basis of stable marriages, which is at least, I believe, epidemic among the sort of poorer half of the population,
mm-hmm,
as compared with the richer half of the population. At least the studies I've had is that people who have professional degrees and who are making decent incomes tend to stay married or at least replace spouses and provide something like normal, mm-hmm, families with 2 adults.
Yeah.
Whereas men aren't rich enough to support families in the working class environment.
Mm-hmm.
And the result is that there's either less energy or less competence to guide the children that are raised in that setting.
Right.
And there's no institutional arrangement that compensates for that,
mm-hmm,
lack. So one issue would be to make sure that families have enough money to support themselves and to maintain stability. And the other would be to provide through the educational system a kind of mentoring and or in loco parentis guidance,
yeah,
that was consistent. And, mm-hmm, I think that there actually are technological possibilities, especially arising with internet instruction,
mm-hmm,
and which if it were arranged in the right way, would maintain the morale of students while disseminating access to the best and brightest teachers in the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And but, speaking of technology, actually, as we were talking about like different structures, different social structures that might help to solve some of our economic and interpersonal issues, one that I thought of is that in computer software, you know, there's more of this movement towards freeware and shareware, where people are essentially creating software and giving it away. Sometimes with a digital donation bucket, but it's it seems like there is sort of maybe in an underground sense right now this movement towards voluntarism, towards collaboration, and away from the old hierarchical financial structures. So that's very interesting to me because it indicates that there is a possibility of restructuring. And I think we're getting to a point where it needs to happen. You know, we're kind of a post-industrialist society. So what happens when you're post-industrialist is, you know, you have to find a new economic model.
I think it's very complicated.
It is, for sure.
and that one of the complicating things is that people who are, most in need of the resources that would get us out of our current difficulties,
mm-hmm.
are the ones who have the least political clout.
Right.
And it's political clout in a way that guarantees that such resources are available.
Mm-hmm.
And the other element here is that there's a huge amount of social inertia built into the current institutional arrangements.
Oh, yeah.
And that it's very difficult.
A lot of fear of change.
Well, it's not just fear of change. It's the fact is that the way in which, say, teachers are organized and schools are organized has a historically stable, predictable set of ground rules. And that if you're going to dramatically change the structure of education, for example, then what happens to teachers? How are their roles redefined? How are their careers and compensation to be managed? Are there going to be new metrics for performance? That, for example, or let me talk more about medicine.
Yeah.
During my lifetime as a practicing physician, I was able to start as a solo practitioner and maintain during my whole professional practice, solo practitioner.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was out of commission when I was put in prison and stopped practicing. But after I got out, it seemed to me that most of the doctors that I've had contact with, either personally or through the guidance of friends and relatives, have been cogs in a big machine. And the machinery that they're cogs in are dictating, first of all, it's not just government regulations, it's insurance regulations, it's compensation regulations,
mm-hmm.
and that much of their energy is actually focused not so much on treating or maintaining relations with patients, but it is in negotiating the ground rules of these institutional arrangements. Again, in ways that, as you pointed out earlier, or as I pointed out earlier, limits them to relatively standardized and routinized approaches, which may not be sufficiently flexible to accommodate the differences between individual patients.
Mm-hmm.
So on the one hand, there's been a kind of debasing of what it means to be in medical practice.
Yeah.
And the net result of that,
mm-hmm.
Done under the guise of insurance domination and perhaps saving money or even increasing the statistical probability of effective treatment,
mm-hmm.
is that the people who are actually working in these organizations are becoming increasingly demoralized.
Right.
So that doctor burnout is a big current problem. And a whole generation of older and experienced doctors are saying, why bother?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Apart from criminalization, it's the sort of daily wear and tear of trying to negotiate in a circumstance in which what one had hoped, I imagine, a reasonable degree of professional mm-hmm. autonomy is subordinated to a leviathan of a bureaucratic state.
Right. Absolutely. And you mentioned the insurance companies because, you know, we have two kind of monsters that we're dealing with, one being the government, the regulations, the DEA saying, giving these blanket rules for how pain should be treated, how medicine should be handled. And then you have the insurance companies that are in there purely for their financial objectives. And they're telling the doctors how to practice medicine too. For example, now, if you have a sudden problem, before you can get any images done, you have to go through physical therapy because the insurance insists upon it. And people should not be going into physical therapy before a diagnosis.
Well, what you're illustrating is just one example of a way in which medical decision-making is completely just distorted by a set of mm-hmm. arbitrary rules.
Right. And the doctor can say, yeah, I'd like to do the image. That would be the right way to do this. But you have to go to physical therapy. And it doesn't even really make economic sense. Because so the insurance is going to pay for 6 weeks of physical therapy as opposed to one image that might negate the need for the physical therapy, might negate the need for any further treatment.
Well, there's another sense in which the whole medical economy is completely crazy.
It's
which
crazy.
Is that it's one of administered prices.
Mm-hmm.
And because they're administered prices, they're not responsive to actual changes in market demand.
Right.
So, for example, with the aging of the population, one would expect that you'd need more geriatricians mm-hmm. and more general primary care doctors. And yet those are the people who are least well compensated, and therefore the attraction to go into those fields is diminished.
Yep.
So if
it I mean
among
a
the among the irrationalities is the fact that our whole allocation of manpower is not responsive to the demand, to the medical demands of the population.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So a circumstance in which there were, instead of administered pricing, freer pricing, or some mechanism of balancing, what shall I call it, protection of consumers against catastrophe and bankruptcy, while allowing pricing to reflect actual demand.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, another pet
talk. there's so much we can talk about. It's such a broad subject, but I like that we've gotten into some of these societal issues that I believe are really key to this whole topic. Because when we talk about medical freedom and what is it and how do you establish a right this late in the formation of our country, like religious freedom was put right there in the beginning, and there's still issues about what constitutes religious freedom, where how do we protect religious freedom without encroaching on another right, like freedom of speech and so on, as we know fills the headlines today.
There's another anomaly, which is that the political rhetoric around this seems to assume that, in fact, the government is not interfering with the doctor-patient relationship, when, in fact, it doesn't completely.
It is. The government's there in the room with you.
but my point about this argument when it was against the Affordable Care Act
mm-hmm.
Was that now the government is going to control your doctor and your patient relationship as if it doesn't already.
Right.
And as if the insurance companies don't already.
That was my issue with the Affordable Care Act is that it's not straight up government providing medicine. It's now a government framework built around the existing insurance companies. So the problem was never eradicated. It was just in case.
That's right. It's acknowledged. No, there's a mythology that replaces the reality. And the mythology is that there actually is more freedom in the system than there is.
There's what in the system?
In the medical system, the mythology was that before the Affordable Care Act, there was more freedom in the medical system than there actually was.
Mm-hmm.
That the movement toward bureaucratization and standardization, and the changes in reimbursement rules that made it very difficult for independent practitioners to maintain themselves, essentially had been degrading, in my view, medical opportunity and the responsiveness of doctors to patients for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And that the attempt to mitigate risk to patients is in also missing the point. That is, mitigating what I'll call first dollar risk is very expensive. Mitigating bankruptcy risk should not be very expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And that the focus on insurance, in a way, should be to have the price system respond to actual demands and allow freedom for medical provision to accommodate the various sectors of the market as they can.
Right.
And where the public health interest is paramount,
mm-hmm.
then the government, in effect, should pay for the intervention,
mm-hmm.
as it does for certain kinds of public health matters.
Mm-hmm.
So care of tuberculosis, for example,
right.
or effectively treatment of vaccinations of severe infectious diseases.
Mm-hmm.
In any event, I don't know where else you want to discuss.
Well, also, I just want to go back to like that article we were talking about this morning, the one on The Guardian about the making of an opioid epidemic. You know, the thing is, you know, both approaches to pain medicine are right, depending on who the patient is. Some people need more medicine. I'm the partner of a chronic pain patient. He's one of those people who needs quite a bit of medicine to be effective. He's been under-medicated now for over 5 years. And as a partner and caregiver, I have definitely seen his quality of life go down as the medicines were lowered. He used to be able to enjoy photography, go out social visits. We could go to friends' houses and, you know, just sit and have a social evening. Those types of things are out of the question now. And in this article that I was reading this morning was talking about people who, supposed people from the medical profession seeing the opposite, that people who are treated with high-level medicine are not doing as well. But that's totally the opposite of what I've seen in real life with a chronic pain patient. On the other hand, myself, I'm like the complete opposite of him. I'm like, if I take any pain medicine at all, it has to be like really, really low levels. And I had to go through a surgery a couple of years ago. And when I was discussing the pain medicine with the doctor, he's saying how he's going to give me like 10 milligram Oxycontin. I said, could you make it 5? And he looked at me and he goes, if you can't take 10, then you don't get any at all. And I was like, okay, I got to go with 10 then. I'm not going to have, you know, I don't want to be without any at all. But I know myself, I do better with the like the lowest dose possible. So
let me interject here. Again, dealing with chronic pain patients as opposed to postoperative mm-hmm. or acute pain problems is a different matter. And almost everybody yes. develops tolerance.
Right.
And one of the weaknesses of, let's say, the science relating to this is that there are strategies that would mitigate or reduce tolerance.
Mm-hmm.
And tolerance is what both increases the expense of pain treatment and, at least to some extent, is blamed for the excess availability. Hold on. Excuse me one second. Go to the other room. So there are strategies that have been neglected to mitigate tolerance or even strategies in the way in which people take medications, which may reduce the development of tolerance and therefore improve pain treatment.
Mm-hmm. You were talking in your video about taking like kind of a different approach to it. Made me think of a situation when my partner was being switched from one medicine to another. And just for like this one day, he had a day where he was completely pain free. And he realizes because he had some of the old medicine in his system and some of this new medicine, and just having this realization like, wow, if the doctors would just work with a combo of these medicines, he's like, I could probably be more pain free and take less medicine overall. But of course, you know, where's the doctor that's going to combine opiates? Doctors are afraid to prescribe even one. And that shuts out something that might be way more effective for that patient.
Well, yeah. I mean, typically, again, as I mentioned at the very beginning of our discussion, different opioids have different side effect profiles, and some are sedating and some are arousing.
Yeah.
And those differences were exploited in the way in which I prescribe these medicines. Also, some are longer acting and some are shorter acting. And there are still, it seems to me, deficiency and understanding as to whether or not there are advantages in the long-acting medicines versus the short-acting medicines. But these are technical matters that I think we need to discuss now, except that nobody studies these things because of the general stigmatization of the medicine. Also, there's one other fallacy I wanted to introduce, which is that a relatively small proportion of people exposed to pain medicine develop any problem at all with those medicines. And yet a relatively, allegedly high proportion of people who are illicit users of medicine claim that their source of their medicine was medical.
Mm-hmm.
And that those two statistics are conflated.
Oh, yeah. It's a very low.
So that if people say that, If 70 or 80% of the people who are now in drug treatment say it's because the doctor treated me with too many pills, then it's assumed that the risk of doctors treating people with too many pills is going to lead to 70 or 80% of their patients becoming addicted.
Right. And if people think that that's a new catchphrase to get them off of any kind of hook, they'll just go ahead and say that. I want to mention we have less than 3 minutes left to our show. At 3 o'clock, the next block of programming is just going to come on and cut us off if we're still talking. So, Dr. Hurwitz, I want to thank you again for being on the show today. We've had a really interesting discussion. I think we covered a lot of ground and some new ground for this show, and really talking about how our society should and needs to make some radical changes and restructuring. I want to give you an opportunity. Is there any website or organization, anything you're part of, or for more information you'd like to share with our listeners?
I don't have the list handy, but there are a number of actual Facebook groups that are dealing with chronic pain. And perhaps a quick research or looking under just do searching on chronic pain, you'll come up with those groups.
I also want to mention that the Medical Freedom Show has a Facebook page. It's just called Medical Freedom. You can go ahead and like it. It's got a little picture of a poppy there. Dr. Hurwitz, I'd like to encourage you to post any links you want to share on the Facebook page for our show so that our listeners could check them out and get more information. Also want to mention on Netflix is a documentary featuring Dr. Hurwitz, my guest for today. The movie is called Dr. Feelgood, Healer or Dealer. It deals with both sides of the issues and talks to doctors and patients. And if you want just to understand more about the situation, please check some of those things out. So thank you so much, Dr. Hurwitz.
Well, again, thank you for letting me participate in your program, and it's been a pleasure.
Well, we've got about 30 seconds left. So there's the Medical Freedom page for the show on Facebook. There's also some Medical Freedom groups. We've got Medical Freedom Advocates, and there's also one for New York that's Medical Freedom Advocates of New York. And I think that's about it. Join us next week.